Hey there, oh there, you're listening to Super Tool Shed, the only podcast on the internet that knows where Jimmy Hoffa is buried. I'm Bennett the Sage, I'm joined by Mark the Engineer, and today we discuss change. Jon Stewart is out and Trevor Noah is in as the new host of The Daily Show. Is the transition going smoothly, or are there rough seas ahead for the guy? But not everything is changing in the strictest sense of the word, as more and more shows are trying to make their return. Twin Peaks, Wet Hot American Summer, and the rumored return of The Critic has us all asking, why can't we get beyond the past? But first, the pleasantries. Mark, how have you been?
Fucking tired. Holy shit. What else is new? No, I'm clocking a lot of hours in the last couple of weeks, and it's just been making me sleep for 4 hours a night, work 13 hours a day, plus having to do everything else that I'm responsible for, you know, the fun stuff. So
the stuff that we can't talk about yet.
Yeah, it's awesome. So yeah, and as far as car talk goes, there is no car talk. Car is running fine, although it's kind of right now, but I think that's more so bad gas and an actual mechanical problem, so here's hoping.
The less of a bad situation.
Yeah. And if there's anything that I am tired of people talking to me about right now, it's games that they're playing. Because I'm not playing anything because I'm poor.
And working.
So, Netflix has been my best friend, and I got through all 4 seasons of Person of Interest, so I actually took some mental health days to do that. But, I'm not playing anything, but everyone has insisted on telling me, oh my god, have you played Undertale? It's so psychological, or this thing, or that thing, and I'm just like, I'm not playing anything. We've had this conversation before. But, you know, people just feel, you know, like, nothing wrong with them. They just feel the need to, you know, share that, you know, the social aspect of gaming. And they want to share that experience with me, and that's fine. So they can go out and buy me some games.
I haven't heard anything about Undertale.
People won't stop talking about it.
I guess I'm just blissfully unaware. Has it really been that long since I stopped reviewing games? I think it has. Yes, it has been at least 2 years since I stopped reviewing games.
And isn't it nice to not have it be your job anymore?
On one hand, I miss the opportunity to play games that I wouldn't have otherwise played. But on the other hand, writing a 1,000-word essay on it and then dealing with online assholes for sharing such an opinion, then... yeah, I don't miss that. I don't miss that in the slightest. As far as I'm concerned, as far as how I'm doing, rather, I guess I'm doing pretty good, all things considered. It's finally cooling off down here in California, and I have been just miserable every single night for the past 2-3 months. I did not sign up for Arizona weather when I was born in California. I was not given this opportunity to eject myself from this arid desert weather in Sonoma County.
Where would you rather be, Detroit?
I'd rather be anywhere north of the 40-degree latitude, thank you very much. Mm. At least some semblance of cold weather.
You don't know, son. You don't know. You don't know cold weather.
And you do not know scorching, welting hell weather either.
Yes, I do. We have actual seasons here. We've had multiple, like, old people endangering heat waves for weeks at a time. We get all the weather here. We're in that perfectly awful fucking place. And on top of that, we get hurricanes on top of that. So, I don't want to fucking hear it.
What about earthquakes? Do you get earthquakes?
Had one 2 years ago.
Oh, really? Did your DVDs get knocked off the shelf?
No. I slept through it, actually.
Oh, God. How tumultuous.
Oh, my God. Fuck off, bro. Seriously. You have earthquakes. It's just another bit of weather for you. Like, that's what you get instead of snow.
Well, this part of the California. If I lived closer to the Nevada border, I would have all of it.
Even so, you don't. So let's deal with the reality. You've never had to shovel an inch, a pound of snow in your life. And winter is coming. All right? And while you're sitting around in 50 degree weather, pussy ass California, it's like, oh my God, it's so chilly.
I need my parka.
No.
Let's be completely fair here. Have you been to Chicago?
I've only been to Chicago as far as O'Hare.
Mm-hmm. Have you been in Chicago in December?
No, but I've been in New York in December, and that's almost the same thing.
No. Wind cuts through anything that you have on.
Yeah. Wind tunnel. Got that in New York. Shit, got that here.
Mm-hmm. Except your city, those cities are not known for its wind. Whereas Chicago is called the frickin' Windy City.
Wah. And you don't live in Chicago, so fuck off. You visited Chicago to film.
No, I visited Chicago to help raise charity, money for charity.
And film.
But let's not conflate the two, okay?
Uh-huh. So don't talk to me about it, all right? Because I was born here.
So all here's right? this is our relationship, people. I have a complaint that is legitimate, and Mark goes with, "Well, you don't have to shovel snow, so shut up."
Yeah, because I'm offering you perspective, and the perspective is that you don't have to shovel snow, Mr. I have a bad back and shot hips. If you want to come out here smack in the middle of fucking February and help me shovel my driveway, I would welcome the help.
It's like, wow, you're right, I don't have to shovel, but that does not mean that I'm not sweltering in this fucking heat. So, you know, perspective, I could also be stabbed tomorrow, but that still doesn't take away the fact that I'm sweltering in this fucking heat.
God, honestly, like, okay, so let's frame this on the wall properly. Bennett has a huge ass window in his room,
mm-hmm.
but he lives in a complex where the landlord isn't overly keen on window units.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative to this would be to get a standing air conditioner for the room, which is deeply expensive, which is, I don't know, somewhere between $200 and $400, but the problem with that is that Bennett has no actual place to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it stands about as large as a 5-year-old child.
That, and there's no wall outlet that is available in the room.
They make power strips for that, jackass.
I know. I have power strips all across my room.
So it's fine. You just get like one good heavy-duty power strip, no dollar store bullshit that's going to start a fire. But yeah, so that's what it is. It's that the cross is so big, so fucking heavy, because technically Bennett is in the right. He is sweltering against his will, and there is nothing that he can legitimately do about it. But you still don't have to shovel snow. The heat doesn't keep you indoors. The heat doesn't keep you from driving. The heat doesn't make other drivers completely fucking insane. The heat doesn't penetrate through your insulated house through your garage fire door and make your room fucking freezing cold at night.
But the heat does keep me up at night, causing many, many sleepless nights. And you know as well as I do that nothing is more miserable when you haven't slept well for 3 days straight.
Dude, I sleep under a fan all year round, so... Because it's easier to be cold and make yourself warm than to be warm and make yourself cold.
And when you're sweltering in the heat, no fan is strong enough.
I don't know, man. Because that small little heavy-duty fan we bought for the Inuyasha review, that thing fucking pushes air like mad.
Like, I have not turned off that fan for the past month. It's going on right now, actually. And thankfully, you're not hearing it. Otherwise, that would be the most annoying white noise sound to listen to a podcast for, as opposed to the white noise that typically comes out of my mouth during these recordings.
But, yeah, so, I mean, we have this argument every year. Like, I think I have this argument with Bennett more often than I have it, than I used to have it with my mom once upon a time about whether or not it's hot or cold. Because she can't feel temperature anymore. So, that's fun. That's so fun to be around.
You clicked on this podcast to listen to Trevor Noah. Instead, you got two assholes bickering about the weather like two old men.
That's the way it is, man. That's us. It's our special flavor of commentary.
It's our special flavor of Seinfeldian observation.
I would say more grumpy old men.
Well, Seinfeld is kind of turning into a grumpy old man.
No, he's been a grumpy old man for a fucking while, and he is an aging comedic dinosaur in a time when, unfortunately, the college age have told him that he is no longer funny. So it's only the people who he originally entertained that still entertain him. But still.
Go on.
Oh,
I felt that when I heard about that Seinfeld, how Seinfeld just stopped going to college route because everyone says that he's too offensive. And I keep thinking about every Seinfeld routine I've ever heard from the guy. And I've never put him in that same camp as, like, say, Anthony Jeselnik or freaking...
He's not even on the same planet as fucking Jeselnik.
No, of course not. He's not freaking Jim Norton. Bill Burr.
Jim Jeffries, Greg Fitzsimmons, none of them. Anybody who's been on the rotation on Louie, he is none of those people.
Exactly. So, like, what kind of, like, routine are we not hearing that he's reserving just for the college crowd that they find so offensive?
Nothing, man. It's just fucking the Smith and Wesson fucking, like, Seinfeld 9mm trigger warning all over the goddamn place. That's what it is. Not like, and that's not to say that, you know, they're necessarily in the wrong, because the conversation right now is ongoing. And Sarah Silverman, like, I've been quoting this very often since I heard it, where Sarah Silverman in an interview started talking about how the college aged are usually on the right side of history, and how, you know, like, why is it that we should resist adjusting language in order to be less offensive to the people around us? And I genuinely gave that a lot of thought, you know, because she was talking about how the word gay was still in her vocabulary from the 80s and 90s, which it's still in my vocabulary, still in all my 90s friends' vocabulary. You know, you, like, if something is stupid, if something is pissing you off, it's like, oh, that is fucking gay! But, you know, like, and if there were a gay person in, like, in the room, you don't necessarily feel inclined to, but there is that small bit of you that is like, and I'm not saying that it sucks dicks. I'm saying that it's gay, that it's just gay. But unfortunately, the thing is that, like, we try to separate the word gay from a homosexual person, but we can't, because there is no fucking separation. By saying something is gay, you're saying it sucks dicks, and therefore you are saying that, like, and since it's something that's pissing you off, you are assigning that to something that's bad. So the parcel is now that this sucks dicks, therefore it is gay, therefore it is bad, gay people are bad. Like, and we need to adjust that language. And I get that. I really do. And since I saw that interview, like, I am actively trying to avoid. I'm trying to adjust that part of my brain now and just remove it. I'm not above that. I'm not above just removing bits of language from my brain where it's like, well, that could, you know, like, not that, like, oh, that could piss somebody off, but, like, well, that could be hurtful to someone if they process that in the same way that I just processed it. So, and yeah. Seinfeld and every comedian like him, you know, fucking Nick DiPaolo, they're railing against that change because they don't see the necessity in change. Like, why should I have to change? Well, it's cutting into your bottom line now, and that doesn't matter as much for Seinfeld because syndication, but that would matter more to other aging comedians, you know, Fitzsimmons, DiPaolo, Barry, Stanhope, you know.
I don't know. Stanhope, I think, is resting on the fact that he will never, ever be a mainstream comedian, and he prefers to be in those smoke-filled rooms just talking dirty jokes to people that, you know, quite frankly, know that they're offensive, but they just don't care.
Yeah. See, I don't know. Like, well, it's just because Stanhope isn't just an offensive comedian. He is a dirty comedian. You know, he's all, like, he's all the best, worst parts of fucking Dice.
Except without the irritating, like, rhyming thing.
Yeah. And, like, I'll genuinely say that Beer Hall Push was hard to watch.
Not for me. I really love Beer Hall Push. Mainly because he has a way of conveying a story that I find, you know, like, you can't you know, look away from. And there is a sense that when he's telling the story, he's laughing along with the audience, like he would, like you would listen to a friend tell you a story.
Well, the last one, his last special before that was amazing. And maybe I just need to watch Beer Hall Putsch again, but it was like, I remember, I didn't think it wasn't funny. I did laugh, and I laughed a lot because I like Stanhope. But there were parts where it's just like cringeworthy, and I just went, oh.
And I think I know where it is. It's the story of his mother dying is very hard to listen to. And the way that he approaches the story is classic Stanhope, in that nothing is sacred. And listening to that story the first time, I can't remember the last time I laughed that hard during a routine, because it was something that I hadn't listened to before. Someone's death being used for a joke. And it's not like they're being disrespectful. I mean, he made it very clear that his mother had the blackest sense of humor from any person that he met. As he put it, I didn't come from nowhere. I learned my humor from the people around me, and my mother raised me to have this, you know, pitch black humor. And like hearing the story of them, like of him and his wife or sort of wife, Bingo. And I'm not too clear about that story, but just roasting her as she's dying, as she's poisoning herself, is one of the most darkly humorous things that I've heard in recent years.
See, it's weird when you can look at Louis C.K. and say, like, nope, that's the line. Louis C.K. is the line, and Stanhope is beyond the line.
The thing with Stanhope is that he's beyond the line, but that doesn't make him, like, it doesn't make him unlistenable or doesn't detract away from his talent. It just means that he's there every once in a while.
Yeah.
He's the kind of comedian that breaks the boundaries that Louis C.K. set up every once in a while.
Yeah, and that's not to say that I wouldn't watch Stanhope's next special. I fucking would. But there is absolutely something to be said about, you know, I can sit through Jim Jeffries, I can sit through Jim Norton, I can sit through Louis C.K. I can sit through all of them on a 24-hour fucking loop with, you know, every Bill Burr special sprinkled right the fuck in. But, like, and I never cringe at any of them, but I don't know. There was something about Stanhope and Beer Hall Putsch that just made me go, ah! And, you know, and the thing is that you're right. You know, like, he's never going to change. And more power to him for never changing. But this argument about whether or not the college aged are on the right side of history, whether or not we should be adjusting language, whether or not the adjustment of language based on people's feelings is thought policing and all of this other stuff. It's like, well, you know what? Like, there are people at stake. And when, you know, when the stakes are people, when the economy is people, you know, like, we all need to sit down and really give it more thought than the quarter second it takes for your brain to lash out against any kind of change.
I think people need to understand about insults when it comes to that is that the meaning of an insult is to put someone down. And when you're using that language to put someone down, it's always people take that insult and sometimes they apply it to themselves, even if that insult was not directed towards them. Because I got an email some months back talking about how uncomfortable they were during my whole suck my dick speech at Doug. During the Sonic the Hedgehog review. And I told him that I didn't believe that the point of the joke wasn't that sucking a dick is wrong. It's that Doug trying to suck my dick would be something that he wouldn't want to do because his orientation doesn't swing that way. It's all about the idea that have them do something that they wouldn't want to do as a means of, like, verbal punishment. And he took that as a way of saying, like, that, you know, sucking dick is wrong. It's like, no, in Doug's case, it's wrong. In your case or anyone else's orientation case, it's a very loving gesture. Yeah, but you have to be oriented that way.
And that's like, and you know what? That's the problem with the solid state of entertainment is, you know, the availability of entertainers to their audience in the social media age is a really interesting thing because normally, it would be, like, entertainment used to be a solid state thing. It was an eggshell. It was, you know, it only existed in the state that you consumed it, and that was it. And if you tried to modify it, it's broken. So, but now we have, you know, the ability to tweet at people, to Facebook at people, to Ask FM people, to express our feelings about how, you know, like how that particular joke made us feel, or how, you know, that particular like 5 minute long tirade affected us. And now, you know, like some people feel like, well, I'm being forced to defend myself or my work, or I'm, you know, like, why should I have to do these things? And I've been thinking about this a lot in the last few days, because I haven't been tweeting very much in the last few weeks. I've just been busy. You know, I've been prioritizing work over being funny on Twitter, or, you know, like every once in a while, like I'll have a thought and I'll tweet it to people. Cause like, oh, well, that might actually help somebody today if they got a little bit of encouragement out of my Twitter. But I've been thinking about just the fact that, you know, context can't exist inside of 140 characters. And, you know, like we've already established that like light speed isn't possible, but nothing's faster than the speed of Twitter. So
when it's fueled with outrage, yes.
Yeah. Like nothing like that is faster than the goddamn Enterprise, you know.
There's this great video clip of somebody standing on the corner in a busy street wearing a sandwich board sign that says "fuck the homeless," and he's constantly being accosted by people saying like, "how dare you," blah blah blah.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then cut to the same guy wearing a sandwich board that says "help the homeless," and everyone's ignoring him. I mean, outrage, personal outrage is free and it's easy, but trying to be thoughtful and trying to get outside of yourself is so much more difficult.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I've told stories about, you know, how I stop on the side of the road and I help people, and, you know, being a story in their lives. Guy in the Knight Rider car helped me and then didn't accept any money and drove away. But I don't like telling those stories, and I don't like being public about the things that I do in my personal life in terms of helping people, because, like, whether you watch Top Gear or not, Jay Leno was on Top Gear twice, and the second time, James May was in California. James May went to Jay Leno's car museum, his personal garage, and he's talking about how, you know, how the Prius is important, how the FCX Clarity hydrogen-powered car is important. And he talks about how, you know, how so many people talk about, like, I have a Prius. And he says that the reason why is because, especially because, Americans like to tell people about the charity that they do anonymously. And that really affected me. I mean, I didn't go around telling people that I did nice things for people before, but when I heard that, immediately I just shut down and I was like, holy shit, he's right. You know, like everybody wants to do their good deed for the day and then be validated by those around them and be assured that they're a good fucking person because they did one, in quotation, selfless thing that's entirely selfish, because they didn't do it to be nice. They did it to make themselves feel better. The idea that that charity is only for the charitable, and charity for the charitable all by itself is just the most highly cynical fucking self-destructive thing I've heard in the last few years, because it's just like, well, great. Awesome. Now you make people feel bad about being charitable because they don't want you to think that they're a douchebag. So then they just are going to walk by opportunities to be charitable. And that really worked itself into my fucking head, man. But I keep going, you know, despite the fact that I personally in my darkness fear that someone will look at me very cynically and be like, look at that douchebag helping out somebody. He's only doing that to make himself feel better. You know, like I still keep going because you want to know what? It puts a smile on someone's face, helps them out, you know, like changes their overall day. I was at the fucking convenience store yesterday, and I'm going to tell a short story of me helping another person. And I did this selflessly. I promise. I was at the Wawa with my friend Brian, and we were just sitting in the parking lot drinking coffee near the air pump. And the air pumps are free at Wawa, so of course they're just busy all the fucking time now, especially now that they have the smart pump, which you program in your PSI and then it'll stop when you're full. So we're sitting there drinking coffee, and a woman drives up, two kids in the back, and she goes, "Are you guys waiting for the air pump?" And I go, no, we're just sitting here drinking coffee." She goes, "Oh, okay. Because I got a tire and it's slowly losing air, and I'm just trying to make sure that I get the next in line because I got someplace to be. And I have an air compressor in my car. It's a tiny little shitty fucking $10 air compressor that I bought from Harbor Freight like 3 months ago. And this was before I swapped the tires from the red bird to the black bird. So it's just been sitting in my trunk. So I said, "Well, I have an air compressor in my trunk, and you're more than welcome to use it if you really have some place to be." And she goes, "Really? You have an air compressor?" I go, "Yeah." And I plug it into my cigarette lighter, not hers, use up my battery to do it, and I inflated her tire. And I said, "Like, if you got a slow leak, you know, you could always use a fix-a-flat until you get a new tire. That'll at least give you a temporary patch." She goes, "Yeah, but I'm getting rid of this car next month, and I can deal with just having to come to Wawa and inflating my tire." So after the tire was done, she went into the Wawa, she got some coffee, and she came back out, and I handed her my air pump, and I said, "I want you to have this." She goes, "Really?" Like, "Yeah, you can have it. I'll just get another one. It's cheap." "Thank you so much." "You're welcome." So, you know, and I did that because somebody needed that air compressor. Like, even if she's getting rid of that car next month, you know, she'll still be able to use it for her kids' bikes or something like that. And it's $10. You know, I can eat $10. So, you know, and I did that because, you know, like all of my tires, you know, don't have any slow leaks in them. All the valve seals are good. So I'm not going to need that compressor. And I can just decide, like, I just decided, like, you know what, I'll just go out and I'll get a better compressor. Because the pressure gauge on that one didn't work anyway. So I always had to, like, take it off and use a manual tire pressure gauge to find out what the pressure of the tire was and plug it back on, run it for a little while longer. So, you know what, like, I can eat $10 to make that woman's life a little bit easier and a little bit more convenient. And I did that to be nice.
Well, it's the U2 argument as far as charity is concerned. I mean, of all the good that Bono has done as far as raising money towards worthy causes, how much of that comes with the fact that he has been a braggadocio about it and has been like almost that like
he's been a fucking gangster racketeer about it? Like, mm-hmm. "What are you doing to help the homeless?
What are you doing to help Africa? Now, excuse me, I got to go onto my private jet and have my hat take up an entire seat."
Yeah.
So, like, on one hand, you know, fuck Bono. On the other hand,
it's like, fuck Bono, but we'll gladly keep taking his money.
Yeah. It's like,
and that's awful. You know, like, it's awful that someone who has money, who has the impetus to be charitable, is horrible as a person. You know, like you are a horrible person because of the fact that you want people to validate you in what it is that you're doing charitably. You know, like, it's like, oh, God, whatever.
But on the other hand, it's not like I have $50 million to give to Africa.
Right, but I still, like, I how many times have I said, you know, like, just do your best. Like, no, you don't have $50 million, but just fucking don't ignore a homeless person you walk by on the street. Don't, you know, like, you see somebody who's short a dollar at the checkout, give them a buck. You know, one of my best friends in this life, when I was so young, when Sonic Adventure 2, the week Sonic Adventure 2 came out, I was short by $5. And the cashier said, like, "What's wrong?" And it's like, I'm $5 short. And he just gave me $5. And he says, "Here, I'm sure you'll come back." Didn't know my name, didn't know anything about me. Gave me $5 to buy Sonic Adventure 2. On my birthday, in which my other friend had fucking ditched me. And you want to know what he did that day? He went out to the same store 3 hours earlier and bought Sonic Adventure 2. So fuck him. We're still friends, though. But this stranger, you know, so much older than me, like 11 years older than me, he is, and gave me $5. And he's just like, I've never seen you before, but I'm sure you'll come back. You look like an honorable kid. And I did. I took the bus back up to that GameStop, EB Games it was at the time. It's closed now, but I took the bus back up to that EB Games, and I gave him $5 like 3 months later. And he says, what's this for? And I go, 3 months ago, you gave me $5 to buy Sonic Adventure 2, and I really appreciated that, so I wanted you to have it back. Thank you. And I kept going back to that store. And they transferred him to a store even further away. And I took the bus even further away just to keep hanging out with him at that store. And I still hang out with him to this day. Like, he's one of my best friends. So, you know, like, and he didn't do that to make me feel better. He did that because he had $5 in his pocket. And he easily could have watched me walk out. How many fucking GameStop employees, how many retail employees and horror stories have we read about how, you know, like, we as retail employees fucking just as we watch children fucking walk out crying because they can't buy Grand Theft Auto because we let their parents know that they've been tricked. And this guy who, you know, like, I swear to you, man, there isn't a cynical bone in his body. And he didn't just do it for me. He did it for tons of people. You know, whenever he transfers stores, because he's a fix-it manager. So when a store starts to fuck up and just, like, starts to tank in the numbers, they send him to go fix it. Like fucking Clark Gregg in Sports Night. Or not Clark Gregg, William H. Macy in Sports Night. So in my teens, I would just follow him all over Delaware County. And he, like, and customers follow him. And as soon as he's gone, they're like, oh, where's... Oh, no, he got transferred to this other store. Okay, well, then I want to return all my pre-orders, please. What? That recently happened where our mutual friend called him up just, like, screaming at him. Like, all your customers came in. Like, every one of your customers that comes in, rescinds their pre-orders. Like, why didn't you tell me this was going to happen? He's like, I don't know what to tell you, man. It's not like I told them to do it. It's just that, you know, like, he is such a good guy who does it to be a good guy that people just, like, he could seriously fucking lead an army into battle at this point. Just an army of fucking GameStop customers.
Oh, man. I don't know. Like, I view charitable acts as a means to, as a means to help your fellow man, of course, but also it does feel good. And even though there is a selfish aspect to that, it's not like it's a kind of bad selfish.
I don't know. Hold on. Now, I've heard this argument that it's not a bad selfish or that it's a selfish act. Like, now, here's the thing. If you are doing something unconsciously, if you are not cognitively saying, I am going to give that person a dollar because they are without and I am with, is that selfish if you're not cognizing it that way?
I feel it's...
It's like, is a shark evil? Just because we apply the human concept of, like, it makes us feel bad when a shark fucking takes a surfer's arm? Like, oh, son of a bitch, shark! Those evil little fucking fish bastards! Like, but the thing is, like, a shark is not evil. It is operating entirely on instinct. A cheetah, a fucking lion, all predators are operating on instinct. They are not evil. So, they're not cognizing it, like, I'm gonna fuck up this dude's day. You know, like, a bear in the woods doesn't look at a picnicking family and go, oh, look at that. They're having a nice little picnic in the woods. I'm gonna go fuck it up. You know, no. Like, it doesn't cognize it that way. It just like, oh, there's food. I'm hungry. And it goes. So if a bear does not cognize that it is doing an evil thing because it can't, then by its nature, it's not evil. A shark is not evil. And since these things are not evil because they can't or they aren't, then you, as a person who decides to do something nice for another human being, if you are not thinking, I'm going to do this because it'll make me feel good about me, then from the off, it is not selfish, is my argument. Sure, you feel good afterwards, but you didn't go into it to feel good, did you?
Well, if it's a habit, then yeah. I mean, I return to that Scrooged speech at the end. Like, when you have that good feeling, you get greedy for that good feeling. Because
I don't. Dude, I'm putting my life into my fucking hands every time I stop on the side of the fucking road to help somebody. Because there's no cameras. Nobody knows where the fuck I am. Nobody calls me. Nobody's fucking looking for me. I could be dead tomorrow, and you wouldn't know for at least a week. And you wouldn't even think to call my house until it really became strange that I was gone. After which point, my mom would notify you that I'm dead. So, I'm not doing it because it makes me feel awesome. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. Right?
Yeah, it is the right thing to do, but that's not what the point I was trying to make. I mean, you are you, and you do what you do for your own reasons. But I'm talking about everyone else. I'm talking about...
Who's to say that the average person walking around isn't fucking just giving a dollar to the homeless or a cigarette to a homeless person or, you know, a fucking, like a fiver to a person that just needs to get on the bus and get home because they lost their wallet? Who's to say that they don't just, like, in that snap instant... go, it's the right thing to do. Do it. Then do it. And there's no thought of, you know, I'll do it because it'll make me feel good about me because I'm a sack of shit. So anything that I can do by any measure to make me feel, to make me go from feeling like a 10-pound sack of shit to a 7-pound sack of shit is worth it.
Well, maybe it is. All I'm saying is if there are people out there who would only do that because it would feel good versus not doing it at all, I'd rather have that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. You know, like I think that cynicism in being charitable is a bad thing because at the end of the day, you know, I don't look down on anybody that's doing it to make themselves feel better necessarily. You know, like if it's helping people and not hurting anyone, okay, fine. But don't put a cape on. Like if you really are doing it just like explicitly to make yourself feel better, if you are a shark cognizing an evil act, don't put the fucking cape on. Don't drape yourself in the personal glory of it because there's no glory. You did it for you. You did the right thing. You helped someone else. That's a good thing. But you didn't do it for the right reasons. You know, it should be because the second you think of, like, because if your first thought is you instead of the person that you're doing it for, then you immediately fail. Like, you fail that fucking litmus test.
Well, all I'm saying is, thank God that doing stuff like that makes people, by and large, feel good. Because if it was the complete opposite, doing charitable acts made people feel like sacks of shit, no one would be charitable. Like, if there are brains where some are somehow hardwired into thinking, I gave this needy person $5. Oh, God, I'm an asshole.
Yeah, and... You know, we need to fight against cynicism. We need to fight against so many things these days. We need to fight against the cynicism of charity. We need to fight against people who are absolutely, you know, afraid of change. Like we are just in this huge ass fucking social war, and everybody's soul is at stake. Like it's insane. You know, like it's one of the reasons why it is I don't leave the house.
But I want to latch on to cynicism here for a moment because this episode is partly about the transition from Jon Stewart to Trevor Noah for The Daily Show. And there is a large air of cynicism behind this change. A largely unknown comedian taking reins of one of the most important news broadcasts of our generation.
What is hailed as the last honest news show.
Mm-hmm. And the feeling that I've gotten from pretty much, like, trying to send out my feelers all across, you know, Twitter and Facebook, is always like this mixed bag of like, well, he seems pretty funny. I liked his small segments on The Daily Show before. And it's like, I watched his stand-up special and they were pretty funny. And like, I don't think he's funny. I think this is a huge mistake. And there's also that cynic, that cynic notion that it's going to fail because he's black. And that's a reality we have to face, like, straight on. Because to try to tiptoe around that fact is to, one, be a disservice towards his intellect. And two, nothing will get accomplished.
Well, the thing is that, unfortunately, you know, Trevor Noah is on the back foot. He's like, he's on the black, on the back foot because he's on the black foot. he's on the back foot because he's black, you know, like he's very, like he's extremely, like he's not American black, you know, he's African black, and he's, you know, come from a different standard of social acceptance and education and just a completely different experience. Which, you know, like I've talked to people about, like I've talked to American transplants from other predominantly, you know, like black countries where, you know, like they look at the American black experience and they just go like, how do you stand it? Or they just don't really understand the nuance of subtle racism where they're just like, I don't know, like that just seems really harmless to cast you as a black guy in voiceover. No, it's not harmless at all. And that's a conversation I've gone ad nauseum about. But, like Trevor Noah is at an extremely bad disadvantage because even though he's of mixed heritage and he's a caramel colored brother, you know, and he's like, he's been brilliant on QI and he's been brilliant on The Daily Show when he did his segments, and he's a really good talking head. Unfortunately, once you, like in this country, once you put the black person as your primary anchor, you've got kind of this ticking clock problem of, you know, like, all right, so if something bad's going to happen in terms of the ratings, it's going to be in the first year where, you know, like people are going to tune in, find out that The Daily Show's back, hear that without context, see Trevor Noah and go, who the fuck is this? That's not Jon Stewart. And that certainly isn't John Oliver. So, and then they'll just tune the fuck out. And that's problematic because, like, I remember when they rebooted fucking Ironsides and Ironsides was black.
Or they rebooted Kojak.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it lasted a season.
Both times, I think.
Yeah. Like, and I'm just like, what was wrong with this show? There was nothing wrong with the show. It was shot well, written well, acted. Ah, that's right. They made Ironsides black. That's what it was. You know, like that's just it. Is that, you know, for all the conversation about whether or not people identify themselves in media, which, you know, like I've had conversations with people about, you know, the black identity in media and how, you know, like Dwayne McDuffie was trying to make it so that black people could identify themselves in comic book media and how Robert Rodriguez, you know, has the fucking El Rey network so that his kids, you know, like the entire impetus of fucking Spy Kids was so that his kids could recognize themselves in media that they're consuming. And to be a gigantic effects test for a troublemaker, which ultimately led to Sin City. But
And Sharkboy and Lava Girl.
Yeah. But, you know, like that. But
double-edged sword right there.
But the thing is that, like, I've never had a problem identifying with the media that I consume as a black person because I don't really think about it. You know, like, I've never, you know, like, I live in an urban area, you know, like, I'm surrounded by other black people.
There's this great moment, it seems weird to bring it up, but there's this great moment in a, I forgot what pay-per-view it was, but John Cena wins a match because John Cena wins. That's what he does. And in the audience is this little black kid who can't be older than 5, and he is tearing up and raising his arms high because John Cena won. He's wearing a John Cena t-shirt. He's got the You Know See Me armbands. He's part of the Cena Nation, and he is just cheering his little heart out, and it is heartwarming to see. And I'm thinking, to that little kid, it doesn't matter that John Cena isn't black. John Cena is John Cena, and John Cena is his hero.
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, I really do think that of all the things that we are thinking about a lot There are certain things that we are overthinking, which, you know, that's on a person-to-person basis. Like, I'm not going to claim to know anyone's personal life experience or what they can identify with and what they can't identify with. But me personally, and I never like putting being a black person face forward, because it's already bad enough that I am considered a black person before every other thing that I am. You know, I'm not a black actor. I'm not a voice actor. I'm a black voice actor. I'm not, you know, like, I wasn't a goth kid. I was a black goth kid. I'm not a gamer. I'm a black gamer. You know, like, it's always the first thing that comes up where I have absolutely called people on it, where they're like, oh, well, I'm colorblind. And I say, really? When you talk to people about me, do you say my friend Mark or my black friend Mark? My black friend Mark. Oh, shit. Yeah, dick. So, colorblind my ass. So the thing is that I've never had this identification problem. Like, I love The Flash. You know, I love Barry Allen. I love fucking Wally West. And they are both extremely white. One's ginger. You know, I've never had this problem. Like, looking at characters that I consume in fiction and saying, like, I've never once said, well, they're, you know, fucking Barry Allen's great, but it'd be so much better if a guy named Barry was a brother. Like, that's never been my problem. That's never been a problem for me. You know, like, I walk out of movies that really touch me with no black people in them except peppering the background. And, you know, anime, where they're, you know, like, black people are like unicorns in anime. And I consume these stories. I take these stories in and I just go like, yeah, I can see shades of myself in fucking Bato. Most recently, I see so much of myself in Ron Swanson.
Then again, we all want to see ourselves in Ron Swanson.
Yeah, but as far as working hard and no bullshit and just, you know, like, looking people in the fucking eye and fearing, like, and obviously, you know, like, fearing the repercussion of being wrong, but just like, yeah, like, I absolutely see so much of myself in Ron Swanson. Swanson's not fucking black at all. So I've never seen that issue. But the thing is that this is an issue, like, in, like, when on the inverse, this is an issue for America at large, where they're going to look at Trevor Noah. They're going to see that he's not Jon Stewart. They're going to see that he's not like them. And that's going to create a problem. But it's not like a big roaring problem, even though, again, entertainment is no longer solid state, but it's going to create this really subtle problem. And any time that Trevor Noah even remotely identifies as black, it's just going to get people offside, and I worry about that for him. Like, dude, just be as vanilla as possible. Just keep pouring cream in that coffee that you are, and you will last a good long time.
I watched the premiere last night, and, you know, true to their true to what you were saying, they started with, like, I'm the new guy. It's sort of like our old daddy has left, and I'm the stepdad. But I wanted to let you all know I'm the cool stepdad, the one that, you know, that's welcoming. And true to form, they didn't mention anything about the fact that he, you know, originally came from South Africa. They made the focus of the show, you know, John Boehner leaving the House of Representatives. And that was the focus of the show. Mm-hmm. And they tried to,
so he, you know, Colin Quinned it.
Yeah. In of itself, yeah. Like, you know, I'm the new bartender.
Because Quinn was the only person who went on Weekend Update and was like, yes, I'm the new guy. Let's have a conversation. All right, let's move on. Because Nealon didn't do it. Miller didn't do it. Fucking
McDonald didn't do it.
McDonald didn't do it. Like, no one has ever transitioned into the Weekend Update desk. Colin Quinn, as far as I know, is the only person that did that.
Yeah, mid-season, too, if I remember right.
Yeah.
But they occasionally make jokes about the fact that you know, like, Boehner is being replaced, so they kind of made allusions to the fact that Trevor Noah is replacing Jon Stewart. And I forgot the anchor's the correspondent's name, Jordan Kepner, something like that. Well, he had a segment where he was talking with Trevor, and they kind of allude to the fact that the joke is that Jordan is, like, kind of on edge, is like, we just bought a condo. Don't fuck this up, Trevor. Because our job's all pinned on you.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there's no joke in that. Is that the weight of the world is on that man's shoulders. Like, he is seriously the make or break point for everybody's job at The Daily Show. Where, you know, like, the transition from Kilbourne to Stewart was easy. Because, and I'd said this to you last night, that Bill Maher took Politically Incorrect to ABC. And then they just remade Politically Incorrect, called it The Fucking Daily Show, put Kilbourne on. Kilbourne ran for however long he fucking ran for before he decided he didn't want to do it anymore. They get Jon Stewart, who was a talking head for fucking MTV, which, you know, that's just inter-office because Viacom. And then somewhere inside of the first year, it's like, well, why don't we make this show not politically incorrect and not shitty?
That all started with the 2000 election, when they actually took time to cover the Republican National Convention, as well as the Democrat. Well, it was actually the Republican National Convention that really catapulted them into discussion of actual news merit. I think that's when they won the first Pulitzer.
And through that, did they finally get the banner?
Peabody.
Like, and through that, did they get the banner of the last honest news show, where, like, everybody was getting it on every side? It wasn't left-leaning, it wasn't right-leaning, it was slightly off-center to the left, but with a whole lot of cynicism, and everybody would get it. And that, like, and that's what kind of made it, like, well, at least they're being honest. You know, like, well, he's making fun of my party, too, but fuck it. You know, and even, you know, because really what it was that they were doing it from the Miller perspective, because Miller used to give both barrels to everybody too before he went crazy and became a supervillain. So, but now, you know, Noah's got all the thunder of The Daily Show sitting under him, and it's like, well, man, you're driving the big rig now. You don't get to have all of these slow upgrades throughout the years, like that benefit that Jon Stewart got and that everybody around, near, and beneath him got, with, you know, Steve Carell and fucking B and Colbert and fucking Black. Like, you don't get any of that preamble. It's just, we are giving you the biggest, loudest fucking monster truck we possibly could have built after this many years of experience. Don't crash it.
And, like, it's tough to see where a show is going to go after its first episode. I mean, let's look at The Nightly Show, for example. I liked the first few weeks of The Nightly Show all right, but then it got to the point where they didn't know what they were anymore.
Well, because The Nightly Show became fucking Chris Rock's Nat X segment.
Which would have been fine if it were funny, and it's not.
Because you want to know who could fucking, like, and nothing against Larry Wilmore, because he's funny, he's extremely well-educated, and he knows what he's talking about. But the problem is that he is a person that's focused on, you know, the personal identification of the audience and just, like, informing the audience. And it's like, well, dude, I'm really sorry to tell you, but the audience that you're trying to inform isn't watching. They're watching anything else. So that's a problem for Wilmore, but, like, I don't count him out yet, because they said that the fucking Colbert Report wouldn't last a year.
But I don't remember Colbert Report's ratings ever being as low as Nightly Show's.
No, but it was poorly reviewed. It was poorly reviewed because Colbert was a caricature. It was an uber right. It was beyond the uber right caricature. The fucking mega Republican. Fucking Dems suck, but put all the worst words in the worst person so that everything that he agrees with invalidates who he's agreeing with. And he was very poorly reviewed, and they, like, and critics were like, he's not going to last a year.
And he lasted, and he lasted close to a decade.
Yeah.
But I returned to Trevor Noah for a moment to parse together this notion that I don't think that they're trying to take The Daily Show into a new direction so much as it's putting a new identity to the direction it's already on.
See, yeah, exactly. Like, I really don't think that Noah looks at the monster truck and goes, well, I'm not a fan of the color. Like, he doesn't. He respects everything. He respects the engine, the tires, the color, the seats. Like, he's not trying to change fucking anything, especially not in the first fucking year. He's going to get in the fucking seat, turn the key, rev the engine, and go towards the fucking row of cars. That is what he's going to do every night for at least the next fucking year. With, you know, like, and every night, it's just going to be small, subtle changes to get people used to it. Until finally, you know, like, and, you know, like one day, the color is going to change slightly. And the tires will be bigger and maybe slightly better. And the engine's going to have better fucking output. And the row of cars is going to get fucking longer because he's been doing these small little upgrades. But if he were to just go from inside of the first year to go from the monster truck that they gave him to a tank, which is far slower, less spectacle, all of that, people would immediately just go, nope, fuck this. I mean, yes, a tank can produce far more fucking destruction, but it's not my monster truck that I came here to see. It ain't Bigfoot. You know?
Sunday.
Yeah.
No, none of that.
Like, it's not. Like, they're, because that's just it. You know, is that people internalize the things that they grow so attached to over years and years and years, and it becomes their thing. You know, it's why it is that people freak out about games when they change, like in long-running franchises when they change, because they personalize and internalize, and that becomes a part of them. And when those things change, the thing is that, like, unlike personal change, where it's, you know, a choice that you can actively make, it's a change that's a choice that's being made for them, and they don't like it. And that immediately makes them fucking, like, lash out. No! You know, like, see, the thing is, like, they weren't ready for Jon Stewart to leave, even though there was plenty of preamble to Jon Stewart leaving, and he didn't make a fucking secret about it, and he was very heartfelt. And he appointed his own fucking replacement in the same way that the guy who played Spartacus, Andy Whitfield, appointed his replacement. And people were like, no! No, it's not fair! Andy was in remission! It's like, yeah, Andy was in remission, but cancer's a funny fucking thing. And you want to know what? There are plenty of actors that die very suddenly and acutely that don't get to fucking appoint their replacements in long-running franchises. That becomes a fucking studio decision.
And wouldn't you rather trust the decision of the person who is being replaced than somebody who's doing the replacing?
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually watched the Nightly Show after the Daily Show just to see if they were going... like, how it's changed over the last few months since I haven't been watching it. And it's just...
It's not a great show.
It's far from being a great show. And
here's the thing. When it first started, I was like, shit, it's the Second Coming of Tough Crowd. This is amazing. Because the fact that they did the panel so early in the show and so consistently, and they still do that. You know, they still have the panel fairly early in the show. And some shows, they have entire panel. You know, no intro. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, that's amazing. You know, there are no panel shows in this country.
Like, and we deserve one. And we deserve one that, you know, talks about tough issues. But the fact is that, like, half the time, the people on the panel are still busy doing jokes that aren't funny.
They're busy doing jokes that aren't funny. They're motivated by their own personal fucking agenda. They're trying to sell a fucking book. They're trying to do... like, that's the thing about Tough Crowd that was amazing. Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn was fucking amazing because it was just Colin and everybody in the comedy community, all of which had no dog in any particular fight. You know, they open up and they've got fucking Leary and Norton and O'Neill and Geraldo, and they just rotate those guys in and fucking out, and DePaulo was a regular.
I remember O'Neill was just Patrice O'Neill just launched into this inspired rant where the crux of his whole argument was that we just need to hate, all right? Like, if we were not filled with any hate whatsoever, we could find a guy with a little dude on a bicycle with a funny mustache, and we all together would say, all right, we hate him. And it's like, yeah, because, like, the human mind is just incapable of not hating. It just isn't. And to hear him put it so well and so funny, just really, really solidifies that notion, and really kind of, I just wonder, like, what would happen if he were still with us, you know?
Yeah, him and Geraldo. I miss them both. I really do. They were just gone way too fucking soon. And that was with Patrice fucking trying to turn his health around, too. like not drinking anymore, fucking cranberry juice at bars and all that shit, and he just fucking gone one day, and it sucked. Like, I remember listening to Preston and Steve, and they were just devastated by the fact that he was gone, and every comedy special surrounding the Tough Crowd alumni became dedicated in some way to Patrice in one way or another.
Jim Norton's special, dedicated, like, and ended on his hat.
Like, he talked about it, like, he talked about fucking Patrice two specials in a fucking row. Like, that's how important Patrice was in his fucking life. But, you know, like, that was the amazing thing about fucking Tough Crowd, was it was bar conversation through intermediate intellectuals. Through intermediate and high intellectuals, because they got plenty of people from outside of their fucking circle. They got, you know, Silverman, they got Louis C.K., they got Graham Norton at one point, and Eddie Izzard. So they were like pulling from all over the place, and the conversation was always riveting, even when we were kids and could barely understand all of it, just like holding on to the back of a fucking speeding car for dear life, like, please just explain to me what that meant. It, like, but still, it was just fascinating to watch.
It was like Dennis Miller's just at it all the time. Once.
Like, yeah, and it was amazing. So when the nightly show came around and there was a panel show, I went, holy fuck, you know.
It's not going to be as good, but at least there's a facsimile. No.
I wasn't cynical. I watched it three nights in a row and said, it's the return of Tough Crowd. This is fucking amazing. And the thing is that, you know, slowly did I realize, like, it's the return of Tough Crowd in the sense that it is a panel show on Comedy Central, but it doesn't have the same spirit, and it has got a lot of talking heads that you would find on regular news shows that can't contribute anything more than they'd be contributing. Like nothing that you wouldn't hear on Good Morning America or on any of the political panel shows on any fucking network, to the point where I'm just like, this isn't interesting. You know, like part of the thing is that, you know, like, you want, like, if you want people to listen, and that's what Wilmore wants people to do. If you want people to listen, you need shit to be interesting. And the thing is that, like, I'm not interested in a rapper necessarily. I'm not interested in fucking hip hop artists. Now, that's not to say that hip hop artists don't make good talking heads. Common is an extremely good fucking talking head. You know, Mos Def is absolutely a really good talking head. Fucking Ludacris, Chris Bridges, he's great on fucking panels, and he's funny.
But with every, you know, like, with every talking head, in comes a Lavelle Crawford to hog the conversation and just try to turn it into, like, some farce.
Yeah, and then you just kind of tune out for a while and you're just like, all right, I'm just waiting for this to be over now, or you just immediately flip the fucking channel. And, you know, like, his producer is really, you know, like, well thought out and really funny. But Wilmore isn't surrounded by all the building blocks of making a successful panel show, unfortunately. Like, I fear that he won't last nearly as long as Tough Crowd, and that's a shame, because he's a good person to lead a panel show. But then again, you know, I would just as happily take Colin back. You know, like, in fucking the documentary by Rich Voss's wife, Women Aren't Funny. Like, Voss is walking around in a Tough Crowd shirt. And I'm just like, just bring it back. You know, everybody, like, just about everybody would do it. Everyone who's alive would do it. I'm sure they'd be happy to, because they're all still in fucking New York. So, because you look at any episode of Louie, and you're just looking at random episodes of Tough Crowd walking around the fucking Comedy Cellar.
And I think in today's climate, Tough Crowd would be a revelation. Because it's not media experts expounding on issues. It's about people who make their livelihood observing society and then taking what they are observing and framing it within a joke. And I think in today's climate, that is a great platform.
It is. So, you know, nothing against Wilmore. I want to see where he's going to be a year from now. I do. And I would hope that, you know, at some point, like, more than anything, I hope somebody comes to me and is like, have you seen the nightly show lately? But I'm not entirely sure that that's going to happen. And with the Daily Show, you know, Trevor Noah's just going to be percolating for at least 2 years before he's done. Not done, like, off the air, like, done before everybody makes their final decision as to whether or not the brew is strong enough or if they need to pour the entire pot out.
It's... it's... I'm hoping for the best, but I'm expecting the worst when it comes to the nightly show. And most telling of all is how it's so obvious that they're pinning the hopes of this show onto Trevor Noah's run on The Daily Show. Because, you know, you can expect to have some of that runoff from The Daily Show into The Nightly Show. And
yeah, because they always do the bounce.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, that's just another load that Trevor has to bear. And so far, he's wearing it with grace, I have to say. I mean, from the way the first episode went, and I'm going to tune in tonight to see how the first 2 or 3 weeks are going to pan out for him.
Yeah, I would say, you know, like if it enthralls you, then you're not going to feel like it's laborious to watch. But if it at any point becomes laborious to watch, just check in like every few weeks and see where it goes.
That's what my approach is to the nightly show right now, and I am just, oh god,
yeah.
It's actually painful to watch the nightly show, if I have to be honest with you. Ugh. And before we forget the other subject of our show, it's a little haphazard the way we're going to introduce it, but last week, Mark here forwarded me Vox or was it Mike? I forget, but it was a small little bit about a John Lovitz interview on the radio talking about a possible return of The Critic. And me and Mark are huge fans of The Critic, as made evident by our love letter to the show during the Twilight of the Cockroaches review. But John Lovitz went on record saying that he would love to return to the show, and pretty much who everyone involved in the show that is still alive, rest in peace, God, I forgot the actress's name who played Doris and Duke. Oh yeah, I forgot his name as well, but he is passed as well. So, but the only people that are involved that are on the fence about it is Al Jean, the producer of The Simpsons, and he said, like, I'd love to do it, but I got a sweet gig here at The Simpsons.
Yeah, but they're talking about Simpsons might end at season 30. That they're reaching the fucking finish line.
And you know what? If that winds up being true, and if that means he's free to do The Critic, then, you know, thumbs up for me. They're like, Simpsons, you lasted 30 years. What other sitcom could say they have done the same thing? You're done.
Like, yeah, what other animated sitcom spawned from a fucking...
A Tracy Ullman show.
Like, well, not just the Tracy Ullman show, but any show of its kind, like Mad TV and Spy vs. Spy. Or, you know, SNL and the ambiguously gay duo. Like none of that shit lasts, you know, like none of the Smigel cartoons. But, you know, fucking The Simpsons spawned from the Tracy Ullman show 30 years.
What parallel universe are we going to live in where a Robert Smigel cartoon winds up lasting for 30 years? It's like, oh man, did you see the ambiguously gay duo last night?
I don't know, man. Fucking, like Smigel produces stuff that has staying power. It's just not drilled into the American consciousness in the same way that The Simpsons drilled into the American consciousness.
Man, TV Funhouse drilled into the American central consciousness like Simpsons. I don't know, but this led to a great question I asked myself when I saw this, because
if you don't say so yourself.
If I don't say so myself, yes. It led to a question that up until now, it never really occurred to me, because this was the only time I've ever heard of news of a possible show returning that actually got me excited. Because other shows have returned to the fold.
Biker Mice from Mars.
Twin Peaks is coming back. It's in the middle
X-Files.
Of X-Files. X-Files. Like I said during the intro, the Fuller House is returning for some god-awful reason.
Yeah, Girl Meets World.
Yes, it's... All of these shows are returning in some form or another, and I'm figuring why, like, there has been the demand for more episodes of our shows that we grew up with, but they're not going to be the same, especially with, like, not really returns of the show, but rather just, like, spinoffs of the show, like Girl Meets World, Fuller House, etc. And I'm thinking, like, why can't we get beyond that? Like, why can't we let Sleeping Dogs lie?
I don't know. I mean, there's a difference between the reunion show and the full-on, you know, comeback tour, where, you know, like, they did the Seinfeld reunion, or the closest that they would get to the Seinfeld reunion. And it was, like, and having just come off of watching Seinfeld, when I watched it, I just went, that, it's like they didn't stop. You know, like, that magic is still there. Because the formula never really changes. And the thing is that the formula, in a lot of cases, has to change because the world has changed, and these characters will have to have changed with it. You know, to watch, like, I can only imagine what Home Improvement would be like tomorrow. I could only imagine what Family Matters would be like tomorrow. Like, it would be nigh on unrecognizable. And yet, you know, on fucking Fallon last week, the Good Burger reunion.
Even though
it was the most amazing fucking 7 minutes of my week.
Even though Keenan never really had that big a role in the Good Burger sketch. In the movie, yes, but not in the sketch on all that.
Yeah, but it was like, it was the sort of thing that, you know, that fucking Malcolm Jamal Warner was probably just sitting crying somewhere. Like, this is amazing, you know? Like, when fucking Keenan comes out and the audience loses their shit and he just mugs at him.
You think that that Kel just rests on Keenan's couch, just counting his Saturday Night Live money?
I think that Kel continues to work, and he didn't take the same path as Keenan, and that's perfectly fine, you know, because he still shows up and stuff, still works, still makes a living, and that he's not ashamed of Good Burger, that he'll still fucking come out of nowhere and just hit you with, welcome to Good Burger, home of the Good Burger, can I take your order? You know, yeah. Like,
still, like, put grapes up his nose and...
Yeah, and, like, he was there for it, man, and he went full fucking tilt.
I know, but, like, here's the question, though. Like, that's for a sketch. Could you actually imagine that turning into a regular series again?
Well, here's the thing. Good Burger isn't a regular series. All that is a regular series. Mm-hmm. Would I watch all that again? Like, would I support? Like, if fucking Warner came out right now and fucking Huxtable's like, yeah, no, we're gonna fucking prop up all that again, and we're gonna do it for the same demographic we did before, you know, with all of these preteen comedians, I'd be like, sure, do it. Fuck it. Like, if Mad TV can last way past its prime, if SNL can be dead in the fucking ground and still producing fucking sketches, the only thing it's accomplishing at this point is simultaneously discovering and then hindering the crap out of really good performance artists. You know, like I hated fucking Andy Samberg. I really did. I was like, who is this fuck? Why is he here? What is going on? Why does everybody think he's so fucking funny? And, you know, like, the thing is that, like, SNL has absolutely been catering to the lowest common denominator for years and years and years now. So, you know, like, a lot of people who are comedy fans are just like, fucking SNL's dead. And The Lonely Island came out, and it fucking came out gangbusters, and Jizz in My Pants was actually a really good song. And people were talking about Dick in a Box and all that other shit, and I was just like, what the fuck ever. But then Taka, from Team Four Star, he had said, like, have you watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine? And I went, no. Why would I watch that? It's like, well, it's really funny. And you like Terry Crews, right? Like, well, yeah, I like Terry Crews as a comedic actor. It's like, yeah, like, he's in it and this person's in it. And but, like, yeah, but it's led by Samberg. Like, no, just trust me, just watch it. And I did. And I realized, like, it was SNL. The problem wasn't Samberg. It was fucking SNL. He was the issue. And, like, it's what made me love Samberg. It's what made me love fucking Peretti. And I loved her even more after I watched her fucking Netflix special. So, you know, like, if, like, I think that if SNL can last so far past its prime, that Mad TV can last so far past its prime, that if Malcolm Jamal Warner tomorrow said, we're going to do all that again, I'd be like, sure, do it. You've had enough time.
And it's not like, with something like The Critic especially, where it's not so much hindered by, like, timeliness. It's like, let's make fun of movies that come out. That was always the crux of the show. And that's kind of what I do today, and kind of what all my contemporaries do as well. So to have a show like that come on the air, it's like nothing's changed.
And the landscape is more ripe for it because adult-oriented animation is the name of the game at this point. You know, fucking Rick and Morty, Archer, C-Lab, fucking Frisky Dingo, like everything that Adult Swim fucking produces, plus all the animation that comes out before The Watershed on fucking Cartoon Network that is going by the Pixar theory of, you know, like, kids don't listen to dialogue, so entertain the parents and make it flashy for the kids. So, like, the world is ready for stuff like The Critic to come back. It really is. Like, it's the world is ready for shit like Daria to come back, too. Like, I would love to see whatever really happened to Daria.
I don't know. I think that Daria kind of exists. It exists in a good time frame for our generation because it was right at the moment where we are experiencing every single high school, I wouldn't say trouble, but just like those high school isms that were exaggerated.
I'm not saying that to go full on fucking the after series for Clarissa, because that was a train wreck. Like, do you remember that when after Clarissa Explains It All, they decided like, oh yeah, it's Clarissa with a job at like a newspaper or something.
Barely.
And yeah, exactly, barely. Like, it was not a worthy successor to Clarissa at all.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that, you know, like, do that to Daria, but then again, you know, like, let's see what a nigh on 100% misanthrope aging alt kid, like, how she functions in the post-millennial world.
Yeah. And I think the big problem at the heart of this revolution, as it were, is that a lot of these shows that are coming back never really had a call for coming back.
Rugrats.
Mm-hmm. Rugrats never had a call for coming back. Hey Arnold, maybe, because the movie didn't exactly... Like, the series kind of ended on a cliffhanger, and then it just never got renewed for a season. And then, you know, like, I believe, was it Craig Bartlett left the show to work on some pilot that never got picked up, so it's just like everybody loses in that equation. I can see that returning just to like have some closure, but not like a full-on series, especially. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like
when they tried to keep Doug going,
mm-hmm.
and that just didn't fucking work out, so then they decided, well, let's do Pepper Ann. It's Doug, except Doug's a girl. It's, okay.
Yeah. And like, there is an important lesson to be learned in something like Aftermath. Aftermath was just actors and producers of MASH not wanting to let go of the show. So they got three actors, Potter, Father Mulcahy, and Klinger, to get onto this new show, and it lasted maybe a season or two, and just gone. It's just freaking gone. Sometimes letting go is the best thing to do, especially when a show has a proper end.
Yeah, because sometimes there just is no encore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the best thing that you can do is just give them the best show of their life and leave them with the memory and the feeling, and that's it. You know, like, I don't need Rugrats back. I don't need Doug back. There's a ton of shit that I don't need back because quite honestly, those characters don't breathe. They really don't. Like, they were... Like think about when Ren and Stimpy came back, and it was awful.
Because they tried to do it for adults.
Yeah, and it was just the worst fucking train wreck imaginable. So, you know, some characters simply put don't breathe. Like, you don't care what their lives were like after. Like, I care about, you know, Daria and Jane. I want to know what their life is like in the post-millennial world. Like, I'm more than happy to see in, you know, like a Jay Sherman, John Lovett's age and what that meant. You know, like, what that means for him now as a film critic in the internet age. Like, what does he do? You know, like, I want to see those things because, you know, like, part of the reason why it is that people latch onto The Simpsons so much is that even though they are temporally stagnant, they still grow with the times. The reason why it is that people are, you know, the reason why it is that people came for South Park was because it was deeply offensive, highly honest, and very shocking. But the reason why they stay with South Park is because they can produce it so fast that it's timely and topical.
And you know, Trey Parker and Matt Stone are funny as hell.
They don't care about Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Well, I mean, as far as, like, they're timely but funny. That's one.
Yeah, but the thing is that the way that the show is produced on ILM caliber fucking computers and their own personal fucking render farm at South Park Studios that produces 56 shots an hour, you know, like, they, like, since that's not hand-drawn, since it's computer animated, like, they have the ability, you know, like, if you haven't seen the documentary 6 Days to Air, watch it. It is riveting television. It's amazing to see how it is that they produce an episode of South Park, where originally they would produce over the standard time scale of producing a show. Still in the, you know, 6 month break buffer, but then they just got to this point when they now produce a show inside of 6 days, written and delivered in 6 days. And that's what keeps people coming back to South Park. The fact that that methodology means that they will always be faster, more timely, and funnier, like, delivering the, like, those jokes fucking land like a fucking Swiss train is on time, you know, just like every single fucking time, because they produce an episode in 6 days. And that's what keeps people on South Park, on top of the fact that the commentary is very smart, and that it is still just as honest as it ever was, and still as fearless as it ever has been. But The Simpsons, you know, like, I got into an argument with someone once about, you know, he was like, well, The Simpsons is the greatest American TV show. No, it's the longest running American TV show. It lost its greatness after the movie. It lost its greatness. Honestly, I would say that it lost its greatness as soon as fucking Maude Flanders died.
I'd say you were being generous there. I'd say it lost its greatness after Dr. Scorpio.
I mean, after, like, I remember, like, the country in a very, you know, like, in the CompuServe age, the country was just on the edge of its seat of who shot Mr. Burns, you know, like, that was a national event.
Like, who shot JR? Like, yeah. Who shot Mr. Burns?
Yeah, exactly. And then it turned out to be fucking Maggie. but, you know, like, the country, like, voted. Who of all the 3,000 fucking characters shot Mr. Burns? Like who did it? And people were just, like, trying to figure it out, and it was on the news. It was on the news, you know, like, and it's very rare when animation and comics make it into the news as, like, a serious story and not just some, like, puff piece. You know, like, people freaking out when they changed Superman to the silver suit. That was news.
Like, the death of Superman, I remember actually seeing news bits on that.
Yeah, death of Superman, that was fucking news. But, you know, so, but the Simpsons doesn't have nearly that kind of thunder now. They could never kill Homer and have people be like, well, who killed Homer? Like, no one cares.
The only time that these days that when the Simpsons will make the news is if the last episode of the Simpsons ever was made.
Yeah. Like it made the news when fucking Shearer was in negotiations threatening to fucking quit. And you're like, oh, I quit. It's like, no, you don't, Shearer. You just want more money.
It's like, yes, I want more money.
Exactly. So don't give me that shit about it. I'm going to quit. It's like, because I just the outpouring of people for fucking Shearer. Like, oh, Shearer's really going to quit. No, he's fucking not. He's holding out for more money. They're going to cut him his check. He's going to stay. And The Simpsons will be the same as it ever has been. Oh, look, they found the money. Just like they always find the money.
I remember they had this exact same kind of spat a few years ago that pretty much all the actors were holding out for more money. For, yeah, like, back-end deal, I believe.
It happens with every major syndicated fucking show. Like, once you break like $700,000 an episode, there's just that final push, like, can I get over a million? Come on, it's just five of us. It's 5 million per actor, per episode, in a 22-episode season. Come on, you can do it!
I'm gonna
quit!
And just rest out the residuals from all the reruns on FXX!
Yeah, you know, like, that's... I'm never scared. I'm never scared when someone's like... When someone makes it a big public thing, like, oh, I'm going to quit, and they cite creative differences... like that, you know, like I've seen what a separation of creative differences, you know, in someone quitting does. People, generally speaking, unless they're like really loud and abrasive, like, then they're not gonna talk about it. So when they get public and they're like, no, I'm quitting because I just think it's my time to go, you know, the show's going in a direction that I can't follow, or there's creative differences, or you just want more money. And I mean, there's no, don't fucking veil it. Don't wrap it in the cape of fucking artistic integrity. You're just fucking greedy and you want more money. You look at what everybody else gets and you're like, oh, why can't I get that too? And, you know, capitalist society and all that, and I get that. But, you know, like, there just comes a point when it's like, look, man, if you're going to quit, quit. If you're going to quit, don't say anything about it. If you're not going to quit, just say that you want more money. That's fine. There's no shame in that. You know, people, I always find it interesting. In job interviews now, they ask you, are you monetarily driven? And when I first started hearing that, it was like, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And I would always say, no, I'm not monetarily driven. Not because it was what I thought they wanted to hear, but because I'm not. I'm not personally a monetarily driven person. I like to have money so that I can help other people who need money. But I don't necessarily... Like, we've had the conversation, like, what if we had $1 million? What if something we did just, like, went gangbusters and we made $1 million a piece? What would we do with it? And the only thing that I could think to do is like, well, I'd buy a more reliable car, keep my car, continue restoring my car, repaint it, drop a new engine in, which is all like a drop in the bucket of $1 million. And then the rest of that money would go to friends who I know need it. You know, like multiples of my friends have all had kids. I would set up trusts for their college fund, you know, like shit like that. So, you know, like when people ask me, you know, like, am I monetarily driven? Or when they used to ask me when I used to go on job interviews, I would always say no. And the thing is that, you know, like, I always, like, they ask you that because they want to know how often and how likely you are to ask for a raise. You know, like, you're going to look at, because you're going to make friends with coworkers. And even though, you know, it's still considered very gauche to discuss how much you get paid. It's going to come up and people are going to talk, and then you're going to realize, I don't make as much as that person. I do more work than that person. Why don't I make as much as that person? And then you're going to go to them and be like, I deserve a raise. I'd like a raise. I deserve a raise. I demand a raise. I will quit if I don't get a raise. You know? And the thing is that, you know, like, there's no shame in wanting a raise. There is all the shame in the world in saying that, you know, like, if you're living within your means right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
or if you're living like not even within your means, like you're well to do, like you can make your bills on time, you have money to save if you happen to be lucky enough to have a career like that, but then you look at someone else and you go like, well, why don't I get what they get? Then, you know, all right, so here's the crossroads. You look at your argument and you say, oh, well, I don't get what they get, but it sounds greedy if I just want more money. Even though it's a capitalist society, nobody would harsh you for wanting more money. Everybody wants more money. Who doesn't want more money? But what we say is, oh, well, I feel like I'm entitled to more money because I work harder than this person. And I know that person makes more money than me. Like, my job is harder, and therefore, like, and why does that person make more money than me and all this other, you know, like, that's, you know, like, to drape it in that, to drape it in, it's not about your own personal want for more money or your own personal sense of greed, and instead about what the other person is getting, to try and diffuse it. Like, I'm not the asshole. Like, I'm not the asshole here. It's them. It's that guy. It's that guy. It's everybody. Like, no, it's you. It's you. And just be honest with yourself. It's fucking you. You want more money. You feel bad about wanting more money because you're a person with a conscience and you realize that money doesn't come from nowhere. And, you know, you decide to get your nuts up and be like, I want more money. I deserve more money. But you realize, like, eh, but if I do, that'll sound like a douche. So you drape it in something else. You try and hide it. You know, you try and hide it in the integrity of something else. So when Shearer was up to quit, I was like, no, he's not. He wants more money. Of course he wants more money. Everybody wants more money.
Why wouldn't you? Oh, man. This supersized episode of Super Tool Shed is nearing home, but there's third base to get to, and third base is known as none other than Electric Weasels. Are you excited for this, Mark?
You didn't tell me we had Electric Weasels. Oh, yes, that's exciting.
I did tell you we had Electric Weasels. I told you I got Electric Weasels all ready to go.
Oh, really? Oh, shit. Yeah, I'm excited. Yay, Electric Weasels.
Yay! Electric Weasels, this time around, comes in the form of an email that I received not too long ago. Of course, the name of the person who wrote this email will be withheld. But it is one of the most baffling emails I have ever been given for... I can't even imagine why he would think that I would know any of this. But, regardless, here it begins. Had an off-topic question is the subject line, which is already red flag. You probably don't get this a lot, but I've been going through the playlist you have on YouTube and noticed some things and didn't think to ask the question until I got to the Demon City Shinjuku review. How much exactly do you know about chemistry? The thing is, I have a psychopharmacological theory that being that, given the right care in keeping track of and monitoring the ratio of via selective crossbreeding, cannabis can be used to treat schizophrenia, if not simply as a more efficient treatment than as a potential curative component. I've already got almost 4 years worth of documented proof of my theory. However, the recorded data could be described as anecdotal at best. However, being that this data is coming from the perspective of one afflicted with the condition the compound is supposed to be treating and given positive results, more so often with the previous form of pharmaceutical treatment, I can't help but feel that there's some validity to be had with this model of treatment. However, that being said, I do require a bit more, read a lot more, technical info. That being precise cannabinoid ratio observation and recording, as well as endocannabinoid and other neurochemical reactions. Also, another problem is that I lack accreditation, big shocker there, in what I feel are required fields for this sort of thing to be taken seriously. Thus being psychopharmacology, botany, neurochemistry, biochemistry, and microbiology. But honestly, I'm pretty sure one person doesn't have the time in a single lifespan to go through that much school and then also do the research necessary for this type of shit to even get to the peer review process. I've spoken with the likes of Dr. Sue Sisley and Dr. Julie Holland and have gotten surprisingly positive feedback from them in this regard. And I feel there's much potential for not only adaptation, but development. Thing is, right now, I feel I've got the positive or negative question answered, and kind of understated the variables that bring about the context necessary for the positive result to happen. But I don't understand the how yet. Like, I get that too much of THC can cause adverse effects in regards to perception and thus behavior, but this can easily be counterbalanced by either increasing the ratio of CBD and other such cannabinoids, or lowering the ratio of THC to match the levels of CBD and other cannabinoids.
Is it cannabinoids or cannabidioids?
Cannabinoids. I'm reading it just as he's spelling it.
Okay. Is this going somewhere?
Anywho, that's kind of the long and short of it. I get how to minimize, if not completely nullify, the potential negative reactions from the THC, but I don't know exactly how things come together and work to bring about a positive reaction in dealing with this sort of psychiatric condition. However, I do know that it does, and that, I feel, begs the question. Anyway, sorry to bother you with this non-anime-related shit. Keep up the good work and have a great week.
That's it?
I know!
That's it?
I know!
I really thought that he was going to go through this tirade and they'd be like, anyway, now on to my question.
Yes!
You know, like, do you jerk it when you do hentai reviews? Like, something!
I know! What the...
I mean, like, okay, fine. Like, there's nothing necessarily Electric Weasels about a dude who's sharing a theory. I get that. Like, that's fine. That's harmless. But sharing it with you, like, alright, like, the parcel of that is that you're a public personality. People see you and they attach themselves to you. They become attached to you. Okay, fine. You know, you're looking directly at them. It feels like you're talking to them. So they feel like they want to talk back. Okay, but why this? That's baffling.
I know.
I mean, nothing against the guy. Like, if you listen to Tool Shed, dude, fine. You know, whatever. I would say blog it. I would honestly just say blog that shit.
Because there's like a kernel, there is a kernel of logic to this. Like, he honestly believes in this. And if what he is stating is true, that he is keeping logs of his observational studies, then, you know, more power to him. But
But then again, like, observational studies of what? Is he getting high while watching Anime Abandon, or is he, like, locking people in a room with Anime Abandon and then,
like,
making them get high, like, hotboxing them?
Or, like, is he finding, like, schizophrenic patients, giving them cannabis, and then just, like, recording his observations? Like, oh, he's not freaking out. It's like, or he could be during a low. That's how schizophrenia works. It's erratic.
I don't know. I'm, like, it's not like I'm scared or like, what the fuck? But that is baffling.
This is baffling in a way that is so hard to really convey. Like,
honestly, like, I'm slightly disappointed in you because this is the second non-really electric weasels thing that you've brought up. Like, you find it strange and therefore you are trying to classify it as electric weasels, but this is not electric weasels. What this is that this is some of the weird mail that you get, but it's not crazy.
For the sake of argument, what do you call electric weasels by and large?
Like the thing with the Sonic review that we saw on TV Tropes, you know, stuff like that. When people go, how fucking dare you, from this place of complete fucking ignorance, where they go on a completely crazy tirade, lose the fucking plot, and just get lost in the words, and then end it with "Okay, thanks, bye." You know, like, that's electric weasels. Like, stuff
that's what happened in the email, though.
Like, no, dude, seriously. Like, that's not. Uh-uh.
Like,
no,
you said, like,
they're. All right, let me explain something to you. You are a public face, and as a public face, it means that, you know, like, you are perceived as talking directly to people. This is the burden of all public personalities, you know, and I'm talking to you, the audience, as well. I'm speaking directly to you. Like, if you decide that you want to be a podcaster, that you want to be a Let's Player or a reviewer, or do whatever it is that you want to do in order to entertain the common man, like the people who, you know, are your audience. You carry this burden of the fact that the individual watching you feels like you are talking directly to them. And as they become attached to you, they will want to talk back to you because it's crazy for them to talk to themselves pretending that it's you. And of course, there are very public ways to get a hold of you. And that means that you are going to get mail that, you know, seems strange, that seems to lose the plot, that seems to meander a lot. But the thing is that it's an open door. There's no doorman for that. Like, you are your own doorman. Now, the strange emails are going to come. They're absolutely going to fucking come. They're going to come, like, the more popular you are, the more often they're going to come, and to the point where they're going to come in multiples every single day, every week, every month. But there is a threshold by which you kind of have to say, it's like, well, there's a difference between a person who wanted something, like, who wanted to talk to someone who they identify with, who, as having spoken to them directly through a show, there's a difference between that, and then there's just full-on electric weasels are living in my shorts, which is, you know, when they just go, and they go full fucking Donald Sutherland. And that's the point when we can sit here and look at it and go, like, yeah, okay. But this wasn't electric weasels, man. This was harmless. And the last thing was harmless, too.
No, I would say that the last one wasn't nearly as harmless as you make it out to be, considering it was just this gigantic religious zealot rant that just was in apropos of nothing that went on.
It was, hold on, no, that wasn't in apropos of nothing. It offended that person's religious and moral sensibility.
Mm-hmm. But never brought up what was so offensive about it. He just He didn't even mention the video at all. Nothing in the video was mentioned.
Clearly was there because commented on the video. So, like, and shit on Newgrounds autoplays. So, oh my God, Bennett, you're killing me.
All I'm saying is that there is a line that I divide between, like, just the weird emails that I get, and I get a lot of weird emails, versus the ones where I can't even begin to think why he gave me this email or why he made this comment.
Yeah,
I mean, I can see a kernel of logic in it.
Yeah, but the thing is that, like, we're here to entertain. We're like, and occasionally to educate, but we're here to entertain. And there is, like, this is the line. I'm telling you this now. This is the line. If someone, like, a weird email, by its nature, is not Electric Weasels. Because now, here we are, at the end of the show, and we're having this conversation, which isn't overly entertaining. Like, it's not. Because we're having to set the parameters of fucking Electric Weasels, when honestly, like, I really don't think that we should have to, but apparently it needs to be said. And I'm sorry, audience. But we're setting, like, a weird email by its nature is not Electric Weasels. You know when it's Electric Weasels. You know it. You know, like, Electric Weasels is like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Apparently, I see Electric Weasels somehow differently than you.
You just see it everywhere.
No, I don't fucking see it everywhere. Believe me, of all the weird emails I get, I do have to comb through them. It's like, no, that's just weird. That's just weird. This was an email where I was thinking, why? I mean, I get, like, I have a face and I was sprouting something scientific, especially during the Demon City Shinjuku review where I was talking about chemistry. But why would he think that I would know anything more than him when what I was exhibiting was nothing more than high school levels of chemistry?
Okay. Here's the line. If there is no point, it is Electric Weasels. If it has no point to make, then it is Electric Weasels. That's it. You know, like the Sonic comment that we got seriously had no point. It was someone's opinion. Their opinion was, how dare we? How dare you? You fucking asshole. I love Sonic. You've diminished my love of Sonic by 0.0001% by criticizing Sonic. Oh my god, Sonic! And that right. had no point.
All right, all right. I'll grant you, this email did have a point, but it was buried underneath his quote-unquote peer-reviewed studies. Like, his one question was, how much do I know about science? And then paragraphs of his findings.
Shaking my head at you. I really am. This is why we can't do Toolshed multiple times a month anymore. It really, like we used to do fucking 4 episodes of Toolshed a month. We used to hammer this shit, but as we got busier and busier and just, like, so busy that we don't even talk as much as we used to anymore. And now, of course, there's just the pratfall of podcasting, which is that you don't want to talk too much or else you'll have nothing to fucking talk about on your podcast. But see, it's this, man.
I'm not looking for an Electric Weasels every single episode. If one happens to come my way before we record, I pay attention to it.
Oh.
But I'm so sorry that Electric Weasels didn't live up to your expectation.
No, as if there are weasels are dead in my shorts right now. That's what it is. You just gave me a dead weasel. Hope you're happy.
Ugh. I think we are literally talked out at this point. So, Mark, do what you do best and bring us on home.
Intro music by Nick Vaughn, outro music by Zero Reynolds. You can follow them both on Twitter via the links below. You can now take Super Toolshed wherever you go. Just go to benthesage.com/supertoolshed. For Ben the Sage, I'm Mark the Engineer. Until next we beat, the shed is shut.